King Charles visits Pope Leo at the Vatican this week, and the traditional Latin Mass returns to St. Peter's Basilica. The National Catholic Register senior Vatican correspondent Ed Pentum reports. And major changes may be coming to the personal prelature Opus Dei as Georgetown University welcomes a new and controversial president. Jesuit priest and podcaster Father Robert McTague reacts. And a brand new report on religious freedom is released in Rome this week. Marta Petrosillo of Aid to the Church in Need shares the highlights. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and always at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. The UK's King Charles and Queen Camilla pay a historic visit to Pope Leo at the Vatican this week for a moment of ecumenical prayer at the Sistine Chapel, and the beleaguered traditional Latin Mass returns to St. Peter's Basilica on October 25th as part of a TLM pilgrimage. For more on all of this, we're joined by senior Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Register, Edward Penton. Ed, thanks for being here. Tell me about this historic joint prayer between King Charles and Pope Leo at the Sistine Chapel. It's the first time a Roman pontiff and an English monarch have prayed together since the Reformation. How significant is this moment for the church in Rome and whatever's left of the church in England?
Yes, it is very significant, Raymond. I mean, it comes at a time when the Anglican community is going through some very difficult times. We heard this week that a big part of the Anglican communion split from Canterbury because of the choice of the new Archbishop of Canterbury, who's a woman bishop. So there's that. But it's also, as you say, very historic. It's the first time that Prince Charles, the King of England, has prayed with the Pope, the first time that a monarch has prayed with the Pope since the Reformation. And the King, of course, is the supreme governor of the Church of England. So it's very much seen as a very ecumenical gesture. And there's other aspects to the visit, too, which are very significant. Him going to pray and become a confrater of the Benedictine Abbey of St. Paul's outside the walls in Rome, which is also seen as a great gesture and a gift to the Anglican communion in that sense.
I know that title was extended by the Pope to King Charles at the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. But the real question here, Ed, is what does this mean? I know Charles is the head of the Church of England, but how much of a reality is that, given that we're dealing with largely a vastly diminished faith when we're talking about the Church of England? In fact, more Catholics are attending Mass there than people are attending the Anglican services.
Indeed. I mean, I think it's seen possibly as a sort of a bit of a help to the Anglican communion to keep them together. But it's come in for some criticism, of course, as well. Some people see it very much as a sort of superficial unity which covers up serious theological differences. And it's a sort of undermines, they say, both Anglicanism and Catholicism, these kind of gestures. But I was talking earlier with Oratorian Father and liturgical expert Monsignor Andrew Wadsworth, who's in Washington, D.C. And he was saying that, he reminded, of course, the roots of the monarchy are Catholic in England. In fact, Westminster Abbey is called St. Peter the Apostle, and it goes back a long way. And Vatican II teaches that the Anglican Communion has a Catholic hierarchical structure, which impels it towards Catholic unity. And so these gestures, he said, give substance to the hope that the British monarch and the Church of England may one day be restored to unity in the Catholic Church. So in that sense, you could read it very much as a sign of hope, perhaps that unity will come some way down the line. But at the moment, it's looking very, very distant, I'd say.
Yeah, well, I mean, that title, Royal Confrater of St. Paul, which is that special chair that the Pope is extending to Charles, I mean, I guess the underlying reality here is, what does that really mean when you have the Church of England still occupying Catholic properties, Catholic cathedrals, Westminster Abbey itself? This was a Catholic, you know, entity that Henry basically took possession of, and it's been in the hands of the Church of England ever since. And I know the, you know, the Catholic cathedral is called a pro-cathedral because it still considers the original across town. But give us a sense of what this really means, Edward. What are people in England, how are they reading this, or are they considering it at all?
Well, that's a good question. I think most people have kind of checked out of religion a long time ago in England. Mm. Christianity, as we said earlier, there's very few go to church here. So it's seen as really probably quite a sort of irrelevant sort of gesture. And another thing to consider, of course, is that the Catholic Church has given many of these very benevolent gestures to the Anglican Communion, but they seem to get further and further away from the Catholic from Catholic teaching. And so you have to ask yourself, you know, what's the meaning of this? Is there really any purpose to this? And is it really of any use? And I think history shows that these don't really have much effect, but maybe, as Monsignor Wadsworth said, it does offer hope that perhaps there will be communion in the future. And, you know, God works in mysterious ways, and that may happen.
Well, and with this new Archbishopress of Canterbury, it does kind of throw a monkey wrench into things, from the Catholic side of the aisle. But while we're seeing bans on the traditional Latin Mass, Ed, here in the United States, you report in the National Catholic Register this week that on October 25th, Cardinal Raymond Burke will celebrate the first Tridentine Mass at St. Peter's Basilica since Francis suppressed the ancient rite back in 2022. This liturgy is part of a pilgrimage that really sprang from Summorum Pontificum, which was Pope Benedict's motu proprio that allowed free practice and celebration of the ancient rite. What should people take from this celebration? How significant is it? Is it significant at all?
Yes, well, it is significant for the reasons you mentioned, Raymond. I think the fact that it was suppressed since 2022 and now it's come back does give a sign of hope that maybe, you know, that there will be a relaxation of the restrictions from Traditionis Custodes. And the Washington Post reported this week that Monsignor Marco Agostini, who's a leading advocate for the traditional mass and a member of the Papal Master of Ceremonies, he said that this obviously came from the top. It came from the Pope himself. So that is a sign of hope, I think, for many who go to the traditional mass, that this could be a sign that times are changing. And then, of course, you've also got Cardinal Matteo Zuppi of Bologna, who's no traditionalist, but he's celebrating Vespers in Rome as well as part of this pilgrimage. He's done it before, but the fact that he's come back to do it again, when he hadn't done it since 2022 either, does show a sign of movement, we think, and that it could be possible that, yes, we may see some change in the relaxation of Traditionis Custodes.
Well, when we interviewed Cardinal Raymond Burke several weeks ago, he suggested, I think we did it for the podcast, and he suggested that there could be an opening here while saying the Mass there, that the Pope might have a conversation with some of the people who turned up for this jubilee, for this pilgrimage, and that might present an opportunity to at least awaken the Pope to the desires of this group of faithful and why they feel so drawn to the old rite. And so hopefully that will transpire in the way that he foresees it or foresaw it.
Indeed, yes. And as I say in the article, there are other pontifical liturgies going on in the United States as well over the next month, which is also a signal, I think, that, that things will be allowed. Some did say that possibly the liturgy, the Mass in St. Peter's Basilica could be just because of the Jubilee year and that things may go back to how they were next year. But we'll have to see. But I think certainly there are these signs of hope. And in fact, there are actually six liturgies. There's Cardinal Müller's actually celebrating a traditional Mass in Detroit this coming Sunday on the Feast of Christ the King in the Old Rite at the Shrine of St. Joseph. So there are more than I put in the article.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your article San Francisco Archbishop Salvatore Corleone celebrating on All Saints Day, the old rite, Cardinal Gerhard Mueller in Philadelphia on November 2nd, then Cardinal Robert Serra also celebrating the Tridentine Rite in Philly on November 21st. So, Ed, are these just one-offs, or is this a determined trend? I mean, some of the places we're talking about, like Detroit, the Tridentine Rite has been banned. So having somebody come in, it's really little more than a showcase, isn't it?
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, it is interesting that they're being allowed. And, of course, when you've got cardinals wanting to celebrate the traditional mass, perhaps it's very difficult for the bishop to say no. And they're very keen to do it. And, of course, we know that how keen someone like Cardinal Robert Serra is to keep the traditional mass going. So it's all part of that. But as I say, these are all positive signs. And in many ways, it's also come since, of course, our colleague Diane Montagna revealed that the raison d'etre behind Traditionis Custodes, if you like, and its credibility was severely undermined because of the misrepresentation of the survey, which was given as the justification for it. So there are serious cracks in the whole the restrictions behind Traditionis Custodes, and perhaps this is part of that we're starting to see things sort of weaken, and that the relaxation will come in time.
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting point you raise, and it's an important one for the audience, those who might not have been following this as closely as we have. Diane Montagna several months ago revealed documents that we had never seen of that survey. Pope Francis allegedly sent out a survey to all the bishops of the world asking, hey, how is this relaxation of the Tridentine Rite that Benedict instituted? How's it playing out in your dioceses? And the word that we were told he got back was it was divisive, it was causing disunity, it was kind of these radicals, upset about the new mass. Well, it turns out that depiction was wrong. When you read the actual return, the data that came back to the Vatican, where did that misrepresentation come from, Edward? Who's driving this is the question.
Well, yes. I mean, it wasn't. I mean, Pope Francis, of course, took responsibility for it, but the people around him, I think, were very much pushing this. And there was, of course, this theologian in Rome, Andrea Grillo, who was thought to be behind writing the document, and he's very, very much anti-tradition. And so I think there's been a lot of that, and I think many of them saw it as a chance with Pope Francis to push this, and of course they did. And did it? It seems very clearly that it was done in an underhand way, and so very much the argument it runs against Traditionis Custodes and its validity. It seems, or at least its credibility.
Mm. Yeah, and Traditionis Custodes, just for those keeping score, that was Pope Francis's legislation that essentially outlawed or vastly restricted the Tridentine Rite, considering it a source of division, which, you know, if you go to any of these local parishes, as I have, it's packed out with young people who are thirsting for the faith, thirsting for tradition, and wanting something eternal to hold on to. And why that is such a danger or a threat in this church today, in these times, in this society and culture, I don't understand. But then again, I'm not a hierarch, and I have no position in the Vatican. Thank you, Lord. Edward, we will leave it there. And keep us updated on what happens as a result of this pilgrimage.
Will do. Thank you very much.
You can always find Edward Penton's excellent reporting at Edward Penton on X, also at ncregister.com. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Raymond.
Lots going on in the church this week, including rumors that Pope Leo is set to break up the personal prelature of Opus Dei and the return of the Latin Mass to St. Peter's Basilica and other significant appointments. Joining me with reaction to these stories and more, Jesuit priest, host of the Catholic Current podcast, Father Robert McTague. Father, thanks for being here. A big story this week, a report posted on October 14th on InfoVaticana.com, alleges that a major overhaul of the personal prelature of Opus Dei is about to transpire. Pope Francis essentially ended the personal prelature, and now new statutes are awaiting final approval by Pope Leo. Currently, Opus Dei priests, lay members, and diocesan cooperators are under one entity. That could change into three distinct entities under this alleged new structure. Father, what is the Vatican hoping to achieve here, and why bust up this structure at all when it's one of the most vibrant groups in the Church?
I suppose it depends on who you ask and who has what kind of skin in the game. Based on the things that I've read in some of the Vatican statements, there was some housekeeping and maybe some reform and some cleaning up of some messes that Opus Dei hadn't responded to with alacrity, if the accounts I've read are to be believed. And Pope Francis had said, you know, you guys got to get a move on about this. And as I read the documents, Opus Dei was going to have kind of a big congress to kind of sort things out in the manner that Francis had urged. And then Francis died and that meeting was canceled. Maybe they were waiting to see if a new administration would handle something differently. I mean, a personal prelature is an odd kind of canonical and ecclesial animal. I don't think we have a lot of experience in managing that. Some people, their hermeneutic of suspicion is engaged, shall we say, and that Opus Dei is too much of one thing and not enough of something else. And that's why they and the Vatican, with a capital T, are looking for some significant changes. Whether the changes are merited or not, at least as I understand it, Opus Dei, as we know it, will come to an end if those changes are effected.
Yeah. And this is, you know, again, it's one of the most vibrant groups in the Church. I know there were some allegations, you know, with some workers, you know, in some of their houses, and that sort of put this on the radar of Rome. But I believe heads of Opus Dei already met with Pope Leo and they submitted their new statutes in June. So they're awaiting some approval. There's rumor that those approvals could be forthcoming. So we'll keep watching this story as it develops. Last week, Pope Leo named Chicago's Cardinal Blaise Supich as a member of the Pontifical Commission for the Vatican City-State that runs essentially the country of the Vatican. Father, what does that appointment tell us, particularly coming on the heels of this honor of Senator Dick Durbin in the United States that caused an international fracas and a group of bishops to come out against the honor and then, of course, in the 11th hour, Pope Leo weighed in and said, oh, wait, I side with Cardinal Supich.
You know, it's a funny thing. People say that when you have large institutions, if you want to get rid of someone without looking like you're getting rid of them, you promote them up and out and away. This is not an appointment to be vocation director in Tehran or Riyadh, for example. He's not going to be the papal legate to Eritrea. This is a very significant move, I believe. And I think it's a kind of a pat on the back. You might say, well, you know, it's just a little hometown pride. They're both Chicago boys, et cetera. That may be part of it. But I can't imagine that you would give someone such a high profile appointment after the kerfuffle with Senator Durbin and not have this being done as friend to friend, as one who can not only give approval and give promotion. And let's not forget, the cardinal is past the retirement age. He put in his papers as he was required to, and his resignation hasn't been accepted yet. So I think we're going to see more of Cardinal Supich, and we're going to see more of him for a longer time than a lot of people expected.
Yeah, and just to, you know, to put this in perspective, the Cardinal Supich Dick Durbin kerfuffle, as you mentioned, that was really about honoring an allegedly Catholic politician who has used his public career to obstruct, indeed oppose, Catholic teaching. And you had at least 10 or 11 bishops come out in the United States and say, wait a minute, this honor shouldn't be taking place. It's scandalous. I guess the message here is it's not scandalous, and one can object to Catholic teaching in the public sphere, and you can keep going on. In fact, you'll get honored for it in the church if you want to salute people like that. But speaking of Cardinal Supich, His Eminence released a video message this week speaking on behalf of migrants. This follows a spate of these No Kings rallies here in the U.S., some of them focused on deportations and immigration policy. Cardinal Supich also had two recent meetings with Pope Leo. Watch this.
Today, I speak to you as your shepherd, but also as a fellow pilgrim who shares the pain of many of our immigrant communities. Families are being torn apart, children are left in fear, and communities are shaken by immigration raids and detentions. These actions wound the soul of our city. Let me be clear. The church stands with migrants. We stand with a mother who crosses borders to feed her children. We stand with a father who labors in silence to build a better future. We stand with the young person who dreams of safety and a better future. Our parishes and schools will not turn away those who seek comfort, and we will not be silent when dignity is denied.
Father, your reaction to this, it sounds like a call for open borders and a clear denunciation of law enforcement.
I would want to know who's asking the church to be silent about these matters. I'm not aware of that. And of course, His Eminence is at liberty to make whatever videos he wishes. And I can understand his intention of standing up for the human dignity of migrants, etc. I would like to see him make a video to talk about the human dignity of American citizens who've been raped and murdered by people who shouldn't have been in the country in the first place. I want to see him in solidarity with families who've been torn apart because loved ones are no longer there, because violent people who've been deported many times have been released into society to kill and murder again. I want to see him be in solidarity with those who were killed on the roads because illegal aliens who can't speak English were given commercial driver's license by the states of California and New York. I want him to be in solidarity with the communities in Colorado where Venezuelan gang members took over apartment blocks. And I want to hear those messages, especially from someone who has no financial interest in open borders. He said what he had to say. He used his best judgment. God bless him for that. I would say his silences and his financial interest in the matter undercut his credibility and his moral authority very significantly.
Yeah, moral authority. Interesting you raise that. I mean, he talked about the wound on the soul of the city. And look, I don't begrudge His Eminence talking about anything. Certainly the poor and immigrants and migrants, this is the prerogative of the church. It is the church's role to welcome people. That's fine. But when you're talking about public policy and enforcement of the law, and you do so after wanting to hold up a politician that offended every Catholic teaching that, you know, everything the church has been fighting for the last four or five decades, you do wonder if there's an imbalance here in the messaging. But that's up to others to make that call.
There seems to be a kind of cognitive dissonance that His Eminence seems to be protected from somehow, and I don't quite understand that.
Well, here in the United States, at what was once considered the really high point of Catholic higher education, Georgetown University, their incoming president, Eduardo Peña Alvar, he has said he rejects the church's teaching on homosexuality and appears to be uncomfortable with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to repeal Roe v. Wade. Peña Alvar is currently the president of Seattle University, another Jesuit school. Your thoughts on this, Father? An individual who is at such odds, again, with what you're professing and what your stated beliefs are.
I did a little homework when I read of his appointment. In 2014, in Common Will, he was writing about a high school in the Archdiocese of Seattle that had fired a teacher because this man had married his husband. And he said, and here I quote, "Of course I reject the church's teaching on homosexuality." Now, my professor's ear would lean in and say, all right, scholar to scholar, where does that "of course" come from? Does it come from reading the scriptures, especially St. Paul? Does it come from reading the doctors of the church? Jesuit Peter Canisius and St. Peter Damian come to mind, and St. Catherine of Siena. I don't think so. I noted, too, that a year earlier, again in Commonweal, he cited with approval an article in a Georgetown University law review that said, well, you know, if you don't support gay marriage because of the fertility issue, then you're against elderly people marrying, and you're against the marriage of non-fertile couples. And that's that kind of glib argument that a well-trained 15-year-old homeschooler can refute. But, you know, 11, 12 years have passed since those publications. I'm going to assume, given his new appointment, he hasn't changed his position. That makes me wonder, what has he been reading and who has he been talking to all that time? I don't think he's read the very good work of Father John Harvey, who founded Courage International and Encourage. I don't think he's read the good work of Dr. Jennifer Morse and the good work of the Ruth Institute. And candidly, I don't think he's read much that I've published or broadcasted about either. This seems to be a blind side. I don't think he's re-examined this issue in a long time. And candidly, I wonder what his knowledge of basic biology is. Raymond, I know we have a family-friendly show here, but I've taught medical ethics. Bodies were designed to do certain things well, and they were designed not to do other things because there would be great harm. He seems to pass over all of that in silence, and I just have to wonder why.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a major position. He assumes it next summer. But, you know, Georgetown has been moving away from church teaching. I think they call themselves now something in the Jesuit tradition. They say in the Jesuit tradition. That's how they kind of frame things. But at this point, what does that mean? How about the Catholic tradition? I'll take that. Pope Leo has made some significant appointments this week I want to get your reaction to. He named Monsignor Joseph Grunwiedel the new Archbishop of Vienna, Austria, taking over from Cardinal Christoph Schönborn, who retired earlier this year. Francis appointed Grunwiedel the apostolic administrator of that archdiocese in January. So this is really a Pope Francis appointment confirmed by Leo. The Austrian Bishops News Agency has pointed out that the Archbishop-elect has called repeatedly for the end of mandatory priestly celibacy in the Latin Rite. He's also apparently believes that the discussion of the ordination of women to the diaconate should not be suppressed, even going as far as saying he's open to the appointment of women as cardinals. Father, what should we take from this appointment?
I saw a photograph of the new, the rising Archbishop of Vienna meeting with Cardinal Schönborn, who he was replacing. And His Eminence is in a cassock and a zucchetto, and he's got his pectoral cross. And the new Archbishop of Vienna is wearing a suit and tie. And again, I have to ask why. What is it that you're trying to communicate? And just speaking, I'm a recovering academic, Raymond. I'm a professor of philosophy and theology. I look at those claims about the ordination of women, of homosexuality, about celibacy, and say, what has he been reading? And again, certainly not scripture, certainly not the fathers and doctors of the church, certainly not John Paul or Pope Benedict. And it mystifies me how this man even ended up on the short list. I don't understand it.
Well, I doubt if he's reading his predecessor's work, who was responsible for at least drafting the Catechism of the Catholic Church. But moving on, prefect for the Dicastery of Divine Worship, the Vatican's liturgical office, Cardinal Arthur Roach urged a group of diocesan liturgical commissions to more closely follow Pope Francis's guidelines on the Mass. According to Roche, quote, "The depth and the breadth of his liturgical vision," Francis's, "offers us countless opportunities to pause for reflection in order to appreciate the great gift that has been handed on to us in the liturgical books." Father, did Pope Francis have a deep liturgical record? And is this the continuation of that liturgical trajectory, if you will?
Well, if we were going to compare deep liturgical visions and compare that of Pope Francis to, say, that of Pope Benedict, one of these things is not like the other. I think His Eminence was rather generous in his assessment, or better said, description of what Pope Francis had said about liturgy. You know, it strikes me as surpassing strange, and I released a video about this recently. A lot of liturgical statements from Rome coming out these days, and from ordinaries in their diocese, is more along the lines of "because I said so," rather than "this is why it's good for you. This is why it's better." If you want people to take a bitter medicine, and for some people, surrendering to the traditional Latin Mass is a very bitter medicine, couldn't you, in charity, in, I don't know, a spirit of synodality, say step by step, "this is why it's better for you. Step by step, these are the harms." As far as I can tell, no one has made that effort just yet, and people are suffering as a result.
Yeah. Well, I spoke with Ed Penton earlier about these traditional Latin masses that we're seeing celebrated in the coming weeks, both in Rome and in the United States. The Catholic Herald reports that the Diocese of Cleveland has been granted a 2-year extension by the Vatican for the celebration of the Tridentine Rite. I suppose the bishop there must have requested it. Father, given the 11 dioceses that have inflicted harsh restrictions on the TLM, what do you make of these new developments? And how do they reconcile it? I mean, you raise the issue. How do they reconcile it with tradition and the tradition of the Church?
Again, I just have to wonder what people are reading. I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s when I was, and this is when the spirit of innovation was coming along, and we were told that unity is not uniformity. 50, 60 years later, we told, well, actually, unity really is uniformity. And we get a variation of the old clip of, you know, "shut up," he explained. I don't see how something that is manifestly good for the Diocese of Cleveland is somehow an object of fear and opprobrium in the Diocese of Charlotte, for example. It doesn't make sense to me. You know, and there's not only anecdotal and observational evidence, there's at least some survey evidence to say there's a very strong correlation between people being devoted to the traditional Latin Mass and also being orthodox in matters of faith and morals. They're starting families, they're producing vocations, and our response to that has been, cut it out. I don't understand that. You know, we're teach, sanctify, and govern. I've seen a lot of governance in terms of "because I said so." I haven't seen a lot of teaching, and I think that's hurting people and causing a great deal of avoidable pain.
Father Robert McTague, we will leave it there. Thank you for your time, your insights, and you can follow Father McTague and the Catholic Current podcast on X at Catholic Current. Thank you, Father.
Thanks so much, Raymond.
Over on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with Speaker Mike Johnson this week for an intimate conversation on the second anniversary of his speakership. We discussed the wild circumstances that led to him being elected speaker, the faith that sustains him, and of course, what could be the longest government shutdown in history. Watch. This week is the 2-year anniversary of your speakership.
It feels like 20, but yeah. 2 years, yes.
Once you were voted in, you had to do some soul searching. I mean, we all have these moments where you're kind of called to something you didn't expect you were ever going to be called
yes.
to.
Yes, and when that happens, you realize you're at the limit of your own ability, and you have to rely upon God's power, right? And it's bigger than us. And I've talked about this with President Trump. I mean, we talk about spiritual matters often, and I say, you know, the challenges we face are bigger than even you individually, sir, and all of us collectively. We need divine guidance, and we do well when we seek that, and God's responsive to it.
This president has brought peace to the Middle East.
Yes.
He settled 7 international conflicts. There are others in his crosshairs, but he can't break the gridlock on Capitol Hill. What will it take? You were in those meetings
yes.
with Jeffries and Schumer. Yeah. Give me a sense of that inner dynamic, if you
will.
Well,
I can tell you that the president was showing real leadership. He brought us all in. He likes to hear the sides of the various arguments, but Schumer and Jeffries couldn't articulate any particular point. They still can't even today.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Speaker Johnson is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show, or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. Be sure to subscribe and don't miss an Arroyo Grande Show episode. It's free. And of course, be on the lookout for this Friday's episode of The Prayerful Posse. Ooh, it's a good one. A comprehensive report on the global state of religious freedom affecting all religious communities was released by Aid to the Church in Need in Rome this week. It finds that governments in 52 countries use systematic strategies to control or silence religious life. Who are the worst offenders? Here to give us an overview is editor of the 2025 Religious Freedom Report, Marta Petrosilo. Marta, thank you for being here. Aid to the Church in Need is a pontifical foundation. It was founded in 1947 to support Christians who suffer and are persecuted. Your latest report finds that authoritarian regimes are mainly responsible for driving the religious persecution we're seeing now. How did you all identify these 52 governments or regimes? And what signs are Aid in the Church for Need looking for while compiling a report like this?
Well, our report, as you said, assessed the situation regarding religious freedom in 196 countries in the world. And for each of the country profile, for each country, we analyze the legal framework and the incident occurring. So in many of the countries, we identify either as countries of persecution, and there are 24 for this edition, or countries of discrimination, and we have 38 in this edition. We identify as well the main driver of persecution or discrimination. And sometimes you have only one main driver, sometimes you might have two different main drivers combining together, creating persecution or discrimination. And in 52 countries, as you said, authoritarian regimes and a very restrictive law are undermining religious freedom, either controlling people, preventing them to practice their faith, arresting them arbitrarily on other excuses only because they are meeting together to pray. So in these countries, the law and the regimes are strongly not only controlling but preventing people to enjoy full religious freedom.
Well, and the report shows, Marta, religious freedom to be a casualty of war in some cases. In many regions affected by armed conflicts, Syria, Myanmar, Ukraine, religious communities often suffered targeted violence. You have terrorist groups. We reported on this last week with Nina Shea. Boko Haram, Islamic State affiliates, Al-Shabaab, they continue to use religion as a pretext for violence against Christians and Muslims in some occasions who reject extremist ideology. Where are the worst examples of the breakdown in religious freedom, Marta, that you all found this year? What surprised you?
Unfortunately, we have many hotspots for this kind of violence. I would like to recall, for instance, Burkina Faso and the Sahel region for what they regard the jihadism, because we saw there really a huge escalation in violence against religious group. The surprise, even though it's not a really surprise, but a region where we see that the situation is worsening is Latin America. And there we have, of course, the example of Nicaragua as an authoritarian regime really attacking the church, arresting and exiling religious priests and sisters. But this is unfortunately just an example. We saw also in that region as organized crime is attacking the church. One example is in Mexico, where many priests were killed. Yes, when many priests were killed during the latest year because of their mission in defending people, in standing for their rights. And this is something that even though the cartel do not attack a priest for his faith per se, but his mission or his pastoral work became something that they need to stop because it prevent them to continue their criminal activity.
The report points to something called the Cuban model, if I'm not mistaken, where these other governments in Latin America, South and Central America, they are modeling the Cuban example. Tell me what that means, what that looks like, and how we're seeing examples of that. I mean, you've referenced a little bit of it.
Yes. Spotted specifically in Nicaragua and Venezuela because the Cuban model, you know, this control, this a strict control of religion that started in Cuba many decades ago, the more and more has been seen in those two countries. So religious activities are controlled or prevented. There is really a difficult life for all the people working as religious priests or sisters in those countries. And the example of Nicaragua I was saying before, it's really evident because we have many, many priests exiled either or even in jail.
The remarkable thing, Marta, is that at a time when you see the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and the Trump administration targeting Venezuela, targeting Maduro there because of his outrageous human rights and religious record, I don't know why the church isn't more vocal. For whatever reason, they're absolutely silent on this when, you know, a little moral cover might be a good thing. But let's leave that aside. Last week on the show, we had Nina Shea here, and we reported on the efforts underway in the United States to have the Trump administration designate Nigeria as a country of particular concern for religious violence. As you know from your report, that country is gripped by Christians being savaged, really a genocide at the hands of radical Islamists. Your thought on the persecution there, and what is the takeaway?
The situation is keep worsening. We have many different issues there. On one hand, you have Boko Haram and other jihadist groups' activity there. And then there is the phenomenon of the Fulani and the attack done by the Fulani that they are also targeting often the Christian community. That the situation is, of course, complex. There are many components in this, but when they attack a church and a Christian community, that's clear that there is a reasons related also to religion. But they attack, we have to say that they attack also Muslim who refuse their ideology. So the situation in Nigeria, we included Nigeria in the 24 countries of persecution because the situation there is really critical.
Yeah. Vatican Secretary of State Cardinal Pietro Parolin was on hand at the unveiling of your report in Rome this week. He condemned the yearly increase in religious freedom violations affecting now 5.4 billion people worldwide. He also commented specifically on the situation of Christians in Nigeria. He said it is not a religious conflict, but rather more a social one. For example, disputes between herders and farmers. We should also recognize that many Muslims in Nigeria are themselves victims of the same intolerance. These are extremist groups that make no distinction in pursuing their goals. They use violence against anyone they see as an opponent. Marta, do the results of your report bear that out and bear the cardinal's interpretation here? I've seen a lot of reportage on this over years. When you look at something like InterSociety, which does a lot of local data gathering, you know, they claim that 3 churches a day are destroyed, 35 Christians are killed. I doubt if that's all over herding and farmer land rights.
Cardinal Parolin didn't say that in his speech in our conference. His speech was really strong and underlining the importance of religious freedom. We were not there because it was outside, but I know that Cardinal Parolin is one of the most acquainted people on religious freedom. He has a huge knowledge on this. I think that what he was meaning, probably we just having a part of the sentence, it was referring to the complex situation there. In our report, we are documenting a violation of religious freedom against all the religious group. Of course, in the case of Nigeria, there are a specific anti-Christian incident, but we are not saying that only Christians are targeted in Nigeria, because as I also said before, in some cases, we have also many Muslims that refuse extremist ideology being killed.
Mm-hmm. Turning to Syria, the massacre of hundreds of members of the Alawite community in March of 2025 is another deeply disturbing instance of, you know, people being attacked for their faith. Christians were affected as well. At the end of April, there were also clashes between members of the Druze minority and pro-government troops, which left nearly 100 people dead. Marta, there is uncertainty about the future of Christians in Syria because of the government of President al-Sha'ara. What can you tell us about that situation?
Yes, there is uncertainty because we all know that the past of the current government that before was related with the jihadist group, and also they are mentioning on Sharia in the new draft of the constitution. So far, we saw attack. There was also an anti-Christian attack in last June. So we are watching the situation closely because at the moment it's uncertain.
Well, tell me what Aid to the Church in Need is asking. What can the faithful do? What should the posture of anybody watching be vis-a-vis these cases of religious persecution that we're seeing all over the globe?
Yes, we are celebrating this year the 25th anniversary of the Religious Freedom Report. And we are always saying that, as the Holy Father said, this is not just a tool of information, it's bearing witnesses. But we do not want just to inform people, we would like people to be engaged. And this is why this year, along with the launch of the Religious Freedom Report, we launch also a petition, a campaign to support this petition in defense of religious freedom, and specifically built on the Article 18 of the Declaration of Human Rights. And so we ask everyone to engage with us, to stand up and to sign this petition to defend together religious freedom. Because as we said, religious freedom is not a privilege, it's a human right. And it's our responsibility, it's our common responsibility to defend it.
Marta Petrosillo, thank you for being here. You can find Aid to the Church in Need's Religious Freedom in the World Report 2025 at churchinneed.org. Thank you, Marta.
Thank you.
He's the director of one of the most prestigious choirs for boys in London, the London Oratory Schola Cantorum Boys Choir. It was founded in 1996. Their voices have graced the soundtracks of Lord of the Rings trilogy, the Harry Potter series. They've just released a brand new CD, a unique collection of sacred music titled Sacred Treasures of Rome. Here to tell us all about the new project and their upcoming U.S. tour that begins next week, Charles Cole. Charles, thanks for being here. 2025 is the 500th anniversary of Palestrina's birth, the greatest polyphonic composer of the Renaissance. Tell us who Palestrina was and why you chose his work as the main focus of this Sacred Treasures of Rome CD.
Palestrina's really the man who synthesized the most sublime, fully perfect polyphonic style of the Renaissance. He sort of brought it all together, and he's the name that's most synonymous with the best music of that period. And of course, as you say, he's got this really important milestone this year, 500th anniversary. And it seemed the obvious thing. We wanted to do a new recording, and we decided that we would definitely have some Palestrina on the recording, but we've also included other composers who were working alongside him and in his orbit, and probably in greater awe of him as well, in Rome mm-hmm. at the same time.
The Palestrina Festival in Grand Rapids, Michigan, I know you all will be singing there. You're touring all over the U.S. And then on July 16th, you'll be singing a pontifical mass at Sacred Heart Church, celebrated by Archbishop Salvatore Cordileone. Tell us a little about the upcoming tour in this special mass and how you sort of laid out this tour.
Well, the invitation to sing came from that festival in Grand Rapids. It's an absolutely incredible achievement of that parish. They've put together a really spectacular year-long festival, which involves a choral meditation and then a mass each month. And we are doing the July one, as you say, with Archbishop Cordileone, which is a great honor, and it's nice for us to renew our relationship with him. We've sung with him before, and we've also welcomed him at the London Oratory as well.
Charles, tell us about some of the other works on this album, contemporaries of Palestrina, and why those were chosen as part of the CD.
Well, I decided to do some research. So I went to Rome last year, and I was digging around trying to find things that I might not otherwise have come across. And what I discovered was quite interesting. There were a number of composers who had great links to St. Philip Neri at the Rome Oratory, which, of course, was highly significant, really, for us as a choir. And very, very nice to see this. Palestrina knew St. Philip Neri very well. He actually died in his arms at the end of his life, which is an extraordinary thing. And there's a particular composer, Giovanni Animuccia, who was a priest at the, it wasn't quite founded as the oratory yet, but in the early days of the oratory, Giovanni Animuccia was a priest working with St. Philip. And he was a very, very accomplished composer. But much of his music went missing. And it turned out that the parchment on which it was written was of such value that it was actually sold to a cheesemonger in Rome to wrap cheese. It just seems like a terrible crime. That music all went missing. But there are pieces scattered around in different libraries, and I found a very beautiful piece, which I was able to reconstruct, O Crux Ave Spezunica, which is very, very beautiful. But there are some other amazing composers on the album too. Another really interesting story is the Anerio brothers, Felice and Giovanni. They were very closely linked with St. Philip and the oratory, and their mother actually used to do laundry for St. Philip. So there's a very close-knit connection there. And all of these people are absolutely standout composers, really incredible.
I want to give viewers a little taste of what they'll hear on Sacred Treasures of Rome. Take a look. Before we run out of time, talk to me for a moment about sacred music and how important it is to preserve it, not only in the liturgy, but in the wider culture, particularly at a time when traditional forms of the liturgy are under attack, being suppressed, even within the church.
It's such an important thing, this beautiful music. And as you say, it has a very flourishing life outside the church. There are so many commercial groups who go around the world singing concerts and making recordings, and that's absolutely wonderful. And they kind of keep the standards elevated as something that we should all aspire to. Liturgically, as you say, it's much harder to achieve. You need to be very, very committed to want a liturgical program that is going to involve music of this kind of level. But there's lots of encouragement. And Pope Leo himself recently gave a really beautiful address, which I'm sure you'll be aware of, where he was actually launching a set of Vatican stamps honoring Palestrina. And he spoke very movingly about the way the different parts move inside the polyphonic world of Palestrina, and they kind of give way to each other. They come together to create very beautiful moments, and then they move back into their place again. And he was using that as a sort of analogy for what we should do as Christians. So I think that's great encouragement indeed.
Well, we will leave it there. Sacred Treasures of Rome by the London Oratory Schola Cantorum Boys Choir is available now at music outlets everywhere and online. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. I know.